Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It used to be an article of faith for the American middle class that if you worked hard and played by the rules, you'd be awarded with a basic degree of economic security, maybe even move up on the economic ladder. And the next generation, your kids, would fare better than you.
Of course, we've known for some time now that that world is vanishing. Wage growth has stalled, government and employment-based benefits have declined, economic risk and expenses like childcare, college tuition, and housing have soared. And faith that things will be better for the next generation, one of the basic tenets of the American dream, is fading.
A new poll by WBUR shows just how much that dream is fading here in Massachusetts. It found that optimism for the next generation is at an all-time low, and that a majority of Massachusetts residents are worried that their own standard of living will decline.
Consider 32-year-old Amanda McGrath. She was laid off a few years ago and moved back in with her parents in Millis. She's working again now, but earns 20% less than she did. She's fallen deeper into debt, and she worries about the future.
Definitely owning a home, it's going to be a lot harder. I'd like to have children within the next several years, but just being able to afford them is definitely something I'm concerned about. I feel like I'm in worse shape now than I have been before. Generally worried about the economy, where things are going to go. How am I going to pay my bills?
The new WBUR poll found that Amanda McGrath is not alone. And we're going to talk now about the findings and ask you to join the conversation. How do you rate the quality of life here in Massachusetts? And how optimistic are you about the next generation? What's happened to the middle class? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also reach us on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. And joining us here in the studio is Steve Cozella. He's president of Mass Inc. Polling Group, which conducted the survey for WBUR. And welcome, Steve. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Also with us is Barry Bluestone. He's director of the Kitty and Michael Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern University. And welcome back to Radio Boston, Barry Bluestone. Great to have you.
Nice to join you today.
So, Steve, let me start with you. I think the most striking finding in the survey is this pessimism about the future. Even in a state that's doing better than much of the country, there's a broad sense that things are tough and will be worse for the next generation. Tell us what you found.
Correct. The message here is that the economic pessimism that's been well documented in other polls is not just something that people think is here today, gone tomorrow. The number that you cited at the top of the show really tells the story. 8% now think that the next generation is going to be better off financially than the current generation.
8%.
Yes.
So everyone else presumably thinks it's going to be worse.
Well, then no. There's some that say the same, but 58% say worse, and 32% say the same. So it is a majority who say the next generation is actually going to be worse off.
And this really represents a shift, and we've been seeing this shift over the last few years. I mean, this idea, this sort of basic belief in the middle class that if you work hard, play by the rules, things are going to get better. We're really seeing this fading, aren't we?
We are, and that's one of the other things that we found with this poll is that the way that the economy over the last few years has affected you really depends on who you are and where you are in life, where you are in terms of how old you are, what your income level is, and so forth. Each one of those things brings a very different set of economic challenges compared to even other demographic groups in the same economy.
Well, let's break that down a little bit. First of all, who thinks they are doing the worst? We're talking, according to your survey, it's folks who are younger and probably earning less money, correct?
Right, and the specific challenges that they've faced are different. In other words, younger people are more likely to say that they've been underemployed or worked in a job below their skill level. They're more likely to say that they've taken on a lot more debt that they can handle, or that they've actually fallen behind on a debt. When you look at people in the middle age groups, they're more likely, for example, to say that they've worked for several years without a salary increase. And there's similar kinds of differences when you look at the income breakdowns.
And Steve, several of these questions included in this poll are questions you also asked back in 2003, right? So
correct.
I'm curious how the responses have changed over the past decade now.
That's a good question, and it's worth noting that even in 2003, it's not as though the economy was stellar. So right. we're not really looking at what is the picture when the economy is good and what is it when it's not good. We're looking at a time in 2003 when it was not good and a time in 2011 where it's even less good. Mm-hmm. Most of the measures that we looked at have actually worsened somewhat or maybe stayed the same. None of them have really gotten better.
Yeah.
And again, that's compared to a year when we know things really weren't good to begin with.
Right. Barry Bluestone, I'd like to come to you. No surprise that people are worried we're coming out of the Great Recession, but these numbers are really stark. Nearly 2 out of 3 people are concerned about maintaining their current standard of living. That really stuck out to me. What stuck out to you? What's your response to what you saw in these figures?
Well, this poll is a fascinating poll. And as you said, if we took this in Las Vegas or Florida or California, that would be even more staggering. I think what stood out here was, first of all, the way these attitudes are actually reinforcing the weak economy.
Interesting.
That is, when people feel worried about the future, when they see the value of their home come down, when they see their income stagnate or fall, they stop consuming. And when they stop consuming, the economy slows down. And that's why it's been so difficult to get out of the recession this time. You know, in their poll, the Mass Inc. BUR poll, in 2003, 42% said the economy meant that they were postponing a major purchase. Today, it's 51%, more than half. Well, that has a really disastrous effect on the economy. The other thing that I found fascinating about it is that this isn't affecting everybody. There's still a small sliver, kind of the Occupy Wall Street 1% or maybe 5%,
yeah,
who actually think things are
one...
getting a little bit better for them.
Right, I see.
It's,
and
most
it's not really the 1%,
else.
It's 7 or 8% at the top, right?
Perhaps.
Something like that.
7 yeah. or 8%. This economy is doing just fine for them, and their future is going to be fine, and their kids are going to do well. But if you look at the bottom 90 or 95%, these data suggest that they are feeling very worried about the future. The economy is going in the wrong direction. Plus, I think what it says is they don't expect it to turn around very soon, which is, just adds to the pessimism that we're picking up everywhere.
Well, speaking of this pessimism, I want to play a piece of tape from one of the respondents to the survey. This is Michael Sattler of Belmont. He's 42. His family has decided to rent instead of buying a house to give him some financial flexibility. And here's what he says about that old middle class idea that his kids should be better off than him.
I think that was a myth. I think we were kind of living a dream. And I think that the world has caught up to us and is a very competitive and aggressive place. And I think that in order for them to survive, it's going to be based on their efforts and their initiative.
I'd like to ask you both about that. Barry, what do you make of that? I mean, he says he called it a myth. For a while, it really wasn't a myth, though. I mean, there was a big section of our history from somewhere after the end of World War II until the mid-70s when you really could expect improvement generation to generation.
It was not only a myth, but we had the statistics to show that in my generation, growing up in the 1950s and 60s, we knew we were going to do better than our parents.
Yeah.
And we did. I think the new generation, that's really being questioned, given the changes in the world economy and changes in the domestic economy.
Yeah. And Steve, you asked the question about this optimism for the next generation, and you tracked the response to this question over the past year. What did you find during that period?
Yeah, I mean, it's never been good over the last year. I mean, the highest percentage who say that they think the next generation will be better off has been 20% in the last year, and the lowest percent who said worse off was 38. So it's never been that people did believe this, at least within the last year.
Right.
You go back to 2003, and it's actually not shown here, but back then a majority did think this. They did think the next generation was going to be better off. So this idea that they're not, or specifically that they're going to be worse off, not even the same as we are now, is one that's relatively new.
Listeners, we're talking about the state of optimism or pessimism for folks here in Massachusetts. How optimistic are you about the next generation, about your current financial situation, and what's happened to the middle class? You can join the conversation. We're with Barry Bluestone. He's an economist at Northeastern University, and Steve Cosella, president of Mass Inc. Polling Group, who's responsible for this WBUR survey that we're talking about. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Charles, who's calling from Newton. Hi, Charles.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
I have two quick points. One is that I think you need to look at the other side of the equation. I'm very sympathetic to the plight that everyone's in and the worries that they have. But the other thing that people don't talk about is that when times were good, people of this generation tended to finance brand new $50,000 automobiles or $30,000 automobiles and upgrade their house two or three times to have the biggest and the best home. And I think that part of the dilemma is bailing out of the debt that they incurred during those times. And the people that spent those good times paying down debt and staying in the same home or buying used cars or reducing debt when the times were good, I think have much less worries as of today. And I think that goes to a more generic change in attitude. I think in past generations, or in this generation, I think the objective now is to finish the game with the most nicest stuff and get to the finish line at your death with your bills paid. And I think in previous generation, the objective was to pass wealth on to your children, which gave them a head start and allowed them to have a better life than yours, whether it be paying their tuition or giving them an inheritance. So I think there's a selfish self-absorption that changes our approach to these things that should be looked at as well.
Well, Charles, I really appreciate the call. Let me get Barry to sort of comment on that. What do you think of what Charles has said? I mean, it's a good point. It might be time to sort of pull up the drawbridge a little bit and think about how to live life a little bit differently.
Well, it's certainly true for the generation that came of age between, let's say, 1995 and 2005. This was the debt generation. You know, income inequality was growing rapidly even back then. People were, they saw their life in terms of how many toys they could accumulate. But in the generation after World War II, you didn't see that. People were buying their homes with 20% down. People were buying and paying cash for cars. They were saving for their kids. They were putting their kids through college, and they expected their children to do better, and they did. So we did certainly way overextend.
Sure.
You can see it in the housing crisis. You can see it in other ways. What's happening now, though, is you can get to the point where we pull in our horns so much, we're so afraid of borrowing, we're so afraid of going into debt, that we slow the economy down and becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that we're going to have a long-term economic slog.
I'm interested in sort of mining the sort of origins of this pessimism. Steve, I'm wondering if there's anything in the data at all that suggests what would bring people out of this funk. I mean, is it just a result of this sour, slow economy, or anything at all in the data that can give us some hints as to what's behind it?
I think, again, it depends on who you are and how the last few years have affected you. In other words, there's not kind of one thing, one silver bullet that would bring everybody's opinions back around and bring enough optimism back that would cause people to sort of take out their wallets again. It really has been the story of many different small things going on in different sectors of the economy and to different people at different points in their lives that's brought the pessimism to where it is now.
Yeah. Barry, you know, one of the things that I'm thinking about, talking about, and you were mentioning this sort of era post-war, 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, where there really was the ability to grow and pass on wealth from generation to generation. I'm wondering if, you know, it seems to me that this pessimism then is really much more than just a function of the Great Recession. I mean, there's really a cataclysmic shift that has occurred here that has to do with globalization, I think, that has to do with, as we mentioned earlier in the show, government and employment-based benefits have declined, economic risks and expenses on basic things going up. I mean, we're living in a different reality. And I'm taking a long time to get to the question here, but I guess is it ever going to go back to the way it was, or do folks really have to adjust to this new reality going forward?
Well, certainly in terms of behavior and attitudes, it's generational. You know, the folks who came of age and had kids in the 50s and 60s grew up in the Great Depression. They were afraid of going into debt, and they didn't. And they invested in their kids, not in 3,000 and 4,000 square foot homes. So I think generationally we see that. And the kids who are growing up today had parents who were in that generation in which we spent a lot of money. I think, what we need to see is a major improvement in major sectors of the economy, the housing market. Nationwide, our housing prices are still down about 28-29%.
Mm-hmm.
People who own homes feel poorer, and they don't spend their money, and they feel pessimistic because of that. We need to stabilize the housing market. We need, of course, to improve employment. It's only going to be that will change these attitudes. The problem is that we now have an economy in which we have fairly rapid productivity even during a recession, which means we create much fewer jobs per $1 billion worth of investment, and we're creating more of those jobs, but they're sometimes overseas and not at home. And so there really has been a fundamental shift in the nature of the economy. Between the 50s and 60s, the terrific period of American economic prosperity, and what we see today, the underlying structure of the economy has changed rapidly.
Changed very rapidly. Let's get a bunch of calls. All our lines are full. Let's go to Lynn, who's calling from Sudbury. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. What's on your mind?
I'm a high school teacher, and my husband and I, we own a home where we're very comfortable. We could afford to have children, but we've actually decided not to have children at all. I watch kids come through the high school on a regular basis, and the optimism that I used to be able to share with them just kind of isn't there anymore. You know, the reality that you go to college, you get a good job, you make money, that's not necessarily true anymore.
So based on that lack of optimism, so based on that lack of optimism, Lynn, you and your husband have decided not to have kids.
We've decided to focus on the kids that need the help now that are already here.
Yep. I see. Well, listen, we really appreciate the call. Thanks and good luck to you. Let's go to Jan, who's calling from Revere. Hi, Jan.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Very well.
Excellent show today.
Thanks.
Yeah, I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. My dad made $43,000 a year. He could support seven people, had their own home and everything like that. But today, $43,000 is a poverty level.
Yeah.
It annoys me when I listen to people talking about middle class. We have to stop pretending that the middle class exists. You're middle class now if you make $200,000 a year, not $43,000 a year.
So, Barry Bluestone, there's Jan talking about the real sort of vanishing middle class. Of course, $43,000 was worth a lot more in the 1970s, but she makes a good point, right? It was very typical that there'd be one father with one middle class income that could raise four or five kids and do a lot more.
Well, to be middle class today means you have two earners in the family or more than that, and you have two or fewer kids in order to be able to survive, as Lynn was saying just before. The other thing is that here in Greater Boston, particularly in Suffolk County in Boston, people are just spending so much more on just housing, particularly if they're renting.
Right.
We've seen for families have an income of $35,000 or less. So this is a low-income to moderate-income family. We asked what percentage of those families were spending more than a third of their income on rent. In 2005, 36%. In 2010, 43%.
Good Lord.
And so you find people, just as Jan is saying, who to have a middle-class income, you need to have $75,000, $100,000, $125,000 to live like your parents lived. And we're not creating a whole lot of jobs like that today.
Steve, I'm wondering if you got any sense from the polling if people are leaving Massachusetts because of what they're feeling here, or given that Massachusetts is doing relatively well compared to the rest of the country, if people are sticking it out.
So far, people are sticking it out. And even compared to before, maybe even sticking it out a little bit more. There's a couple potential explanations for this, one of which you touched on. There's really not anywhere else to go necessarily where you could think that things were going to be better. But so far, when we put the question to them, would you like to move, and if so, where? In other words, in Massachusetts or somewhere else. People for now are either saying somewhere else in Massachusetts or, you know what, I'm just going to stick it out in the community where I am right now.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Forrest is calling from Brighton. Hi, Forrest.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Sure. Well, I'm a high school teacher, and my fiance and I actually moved to Boston in order to get jobs after coming back from teaching abroad for a little while. And so we were lucky enough to both find jobs pretty rapidly, and we're excited. We're both making about $35,000 a year. And everyone's asking, you know, after the wedding, are you going to look to buy a place? And it's just staggering how much of our income goes into just the cost of a kind of shabby one-room apartment in Brighton. I mean, we're each paying upwards of 50% of our, like, monthly paycheck into renting. And so I think you guys are definitely right. It's like, you know, what I assumed as a child would be my middle-class years, you know, mid-20s, have a normal career. It's not middle-class. I'm still kind of living like a college student.
Forrest, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it, and we wish you and your new wife the best. Let's move on to one more call. Insaf is calling from Mansfield. Insaf, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Perfect. Couldn't have done it better.
Good. All right. Tell me what's on your mind.
So, I mean, you know, so I finished my MBA from Northeastern last year, and, you know, in the last 6 months, I've been able to land a new job and with significantly better pay. So, you know, my outlook, I don't know, coincidence or not, is much more positive. You know, and God forbid I were to lose my job, I don't feel that I'd have a very difficult time getting another one.
So, Insaf, you say you have an MBA.
Correct.
Right. Barry Bluestone, that's the kind of degree that I guess would help someone in this economy, correct?
Well, certainly having the MBA and being the dean of a school of public policy at Northeastern, it's not only the MBA, it's the Northeastern University that is helping Insaf here. The fact is that there is a sliver of folks in America who are doing well in this economy, MBAs and other people with advanced degrees. But even there, we're seeing a shaky economy. I have been teaching for 40 years. I've never had so many former students, I've never had so many friends of children of friends come to me with law degrees, college degrees, advanced degrees, still looking, trying to network, trying to find that next job. So Insaf, with his MBA from Northeastern University, is one of those people who's using that degree well, and I'm proud to say it comes from Northeastern.
Steve, I want to talk to you a little bit about how the sense of financial insecurity breaks down generationally. How does it break down generationally? I guess that's my question. Because as I looked at these numbers, it seems that young people aged 18 to 29 have the most concerned about jobs and debt, right?
That's true. There are some concerns that they don't share, but you're correct that they do have a unique set of concerns as well. For example, they're more likely than people in other age groups to say that they've taken on more debt, maxed out their credit cards, that they've been underemployed. But again, then when you look at the other age groups, there's unique problems that, for example, people between sort of 30 and 60 have faced. They've worked without a raise for a couple years. They've postponed major purchases, which, as Barry said, can have a major impact, and so forth. Really, the only problem that people sort of 60 plus have the majority of them say that they've had has been seeing the value of their home decrease substantially.
Yeah, go ahead, Barry.
Well, you know, it's interesting. What we're finding are those people, of course, with college degrees have the lowest unemployment right now. They have the best prospects. But they've often gone into enormous debt in order to get that degree, and that makes you pessimistic about how you're going to pay that off. I was fortunate. I grew up in the state of Michigan. I went to the University of Michigan. I worked in a Ford plant for 3 summers, working my way through school. On one day, July 4th, Sunday, I was building carburetors for the new Mustang. I made enough money in one shift to pay my fall tuition. I left the University of Michigan with a PhD with savings in hand when I landed at Boston College in 1971.
Oh boy.
How many people could do that today?
Right. Those days are gone. They're gone for good, aren't they? You know, you mentioned Michigan, and obviously that's a state where the economy is in much tougher shape than a state like Massachusetts. I'm struck by the pessimism in this poll, even in a state where things are relatively relatively much better than they are in the rest of the country, right? Yeah. Steve?
Correct. I mean, there's really no way to look at these numbers other than what you're saying. I mean, there is just a lot of pessimism out there, both for the short term and how things are right now, and as we've been discussing, even for the next generation at this point.
Let's see if we can get one more call in here. Dan is calling from Auburn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
I was just wondering how much what we're seeing here in the decline of optimism is, or in the definition of the American dream is optimism, is really a 60-year phenomenon after World War II. Going back further into American history, is that the way Americans saw themselves and saw their futures? Or did they think, I'm going to be a farmer, my kids are going to be farmers, I'm going to be a coal miner, we're all coal miners, we're all in this together, and didn't expect a constantly rising vote?
Well, Dan, it's a great question. Let me put it to my two guests. I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer it. Barry, you want to take that question on?
Well, I think it's a wonderful question. I think if we'd gone back and we had Steve at a younger age polling people in the 1930s, would they have been as pessimistic? And the answer is probably yes. But we can't forget that beginning with World War II and then that unbelievable generation from 1947 to the 1970s, we created a new kind of America in which getting ahead was considered the norm. Maybe before this time it wasn't, and maybe it isn't again. But we're always comparing, you know, last generation with this generation, and this generation doesn't look like they have great prospects?
Well, it's a great question from Dan to end this segment. It's one maybe we'll explore a little later. Barry Bluestone, director of the Kitty and Michael Dukakis Center at Northeastern University, thanks so much for coming. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
And Steve Cozella, president of Mass Inc. Polling Group, who's responsible for the WBUR survey. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Up next, the debate over physician-assisted suicide heats up in Massachusetts. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.